the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Our Culture Club guest today has just published her debut novel, Esther Is Now Following You. Tanya Sweeney, you're very welcome to The Last Word.
Thanks, great to be here.
Tell us about the book.
Well, it is a book that somebody has described as being strapped into the Thelma and Louise car that is going off the cliff, which for about 15, 16 euro is good value for money, I think. It is about a woman in her 30s who very, very quickly, her life starts to fall apart and unravel, and she falls into a bit of a depression and decides to harbour a crush on a Canadian TV actor. And this crush sort of takes on a life of its own. And she starts to retreat into this imaginary relationship with this, you know, actor that has no idea she exists. And she finds his kind of super fans online. And they all sort of aid and abet each other. And, you know, it's a bit of a feeding frenzy in this online space where all the Tedettes convene. And they find out that Ted has a supermodel girlfriend after a while, at which point my Esther character goes, nope, no way, he's mine. I'm going to Canada to claim he who is rightfully mine. And it's set in kind of 2010, 2011. So it was very easy back then to finagle your way into somebody's orbit, shall we say. So, and she does this with terrifying efficiency. Chaos ensues, etc. That's all I can say about
it. Okay, that sounds like a great story. Now, I have to ask you, you know, they say write about what you know. This isn't semi-autobiographical now, is it?
I will say I have had some incredible turbocharged celebrity crushes in my lifetime. You know, I've gone from one to the next. I mean, I'm married now, so I haven't had the time nor the bandwidth to really nurture one properly. But when
you're
I was
not married now to some sort of super actor from Canada or something.
Well, yeah. Oh, I mean, I wish, but yes, no, I'm married to a civilian and it's great. But yeah, no, I always loved having celebrity crushes. So I did draw a little bit on that and that kind of limerent feeling that you would have when you're just, you know, mad about someone who doesn't know you exist. Have you ever done that? It's actually one of the best / worst feelings. It's amazing.
So you're writing from the point of view of the stalker.
Exactly. It's Baby Reindeer from the point of view of the stalker, effectively, you know, but she thinks it's a love story. So it reads a bit like, you know, a love story.
But I presume you were working on this before Baby Reindeer, were you?
I was. And then when Baby Reindeer came out, I was absolutely raging because I was like, oh, I wanted to be part of the conversation around all of this. But yeah, it was definitely up and running by the time Baby Reindeer went to Netflix.
And this is a major international publication, isn't it? This isn't just for the Irish market.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it's coming out in the UK next Thursday. I think you can get it in, like, you know, South Africa and Australia and other places.
And would you expect, have you sold the TV adaptation rights yet?
Not yet. I mean, if anyone's listening and has a good $500,000 to spare, I'm all ears. But yeah, so far, conversations are ongoing, we'll put it that way.
You've been writing for years, writing many newspaper articles. Mm. So what brought you into writing fiction?
Look, I think every journalist feels that they are a storyteller. I mean, I'm not sure I've ever met a print journalist who doesn't want to write a novel secretly, you know, or write any kind of book, really. And I tried writing so many times over the years. I mean, I must have about 8 or 9 half finished. I mean, I say half finished. I'd say I got 5,000 words in on a story and something else caught my eye or something happened in my life. You know?
Would you be able to go back to those now?
I mean, I'd say they're pretty embarrassing. You know, it's funny because, like, I wrote this, you know, in my mid-40s, and I think I had to get to a certain point in my life where I was, you know, a bit wiser, a bit less ungenerous. You know, I think if I'd written this in my mid-20s, it would have been a much more brittle, arrogant piece of work, to be honest. You know, I can't really describe why I think that. I just think I was living quite defensively. You know, I wasn't very comfortable in my own skin. I wasn't very confident in my career. I think I would have written something a little more spiky. Mm.
Are you a full-time novelist now?
Oh, God, no. No, no, no. I still love my job in the Irish Independent so much. And I mean, I tend to write these novels early in the morning before my day starts. But look, the thing about journalism, I've said this before, it is the privilege of a lifetime. I get to talk to every type of person from every walk of life. I've spoken to movie stars. I've spoken to people in direct provision. I've spoken to people who, you know, are living with domestic violence. I've spoken to people who are actively dying. I mean, it is the biggest privilege of my life to be able to talk to these people for work, you know. And, you know, obviously I learn so much about the human condition and storytelling to some extent. So I don't think I'll ever give that up.
Interviewed any stalkers?
Do you know what? I have actually interviewed the victims of stalkers, and that is a massively eye-opening experience. I mean, I think once I started to hear from them and hear how frightening it can be, you know, it's so unpredictable. And, you know, I think we're only starting to realise now with stalking that this is unconsented, unboundaried, unwanted attention. It's, you know, I think maybe in 2010 when Facebook was at its infancy, we kind of thought it was all a bit of fun and games, you know, to kind of talk to celebrities. But I think once we're starting to realise now that it is actually a lot more complex than
that. Okay, does that mean you're more understanding of your main character, Esther, than you are sympathetic towards her?
Look, I think it's a complex thing. You know, so many readers have already come back to me going, you know, I feel so deeply for her because you understand that there's trauma and this is why she's reacting to the difficulty in her life the way she is. But at the same time, you're like, I want to give this girl's head such a wobble. I mean, what she does is so deeply inappropriate and outrageous. You know, it's great to read. I think it's hopefully it's great to read about. But yeah, I think you're watching it or reading it going, God, she really needs to wind it back in now. She's gone down the rabbit hole, this one.
Esther Is Now Following You is the first novel of Tanya Sweeney. I'm sure one first of many. Let's get to your Culture Club choices. And tell us about the first single that you ever remember buying.
Oh, boy. Jason Donovan's Too Many Broken Hearts. Listen, this was around the time, you know, the late 80s when every Australian soap star, down to Bouncer the Dog, had a record deal with...
It was Bouncer the Dog.
Right, there you go. He was on Neighbours, I think. But they all had record deals with Stock Aitken and Waterman. It was like this little factory. And of course, when you're watching Home and Away or Neighbours in 1980s Blanchardstown, it looks like the most exotic place in the world. So all of these people came up to the UK and put out records, among them Jason Donovan. It was absolutely, I mean, what a time to be alive. You know, I was there for it as a 10-year-old. And I did get to later interview Jason Donovan, actually, as an adult, and told him how do I put this nicely? How my ardour for him when I was 10 years old, it scared the absolute life out of him. It was a great moment.
Let's hear a bit of Jason Donovan. Too Many Broken Hearts. Was a single interchangeable song for everybody. It just so distinctively Stock Aitken and Waterman, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think they did all sound quite like that, which is probably why we loved it, because there was an unending stream for your, you know, burgeoning appetite. It was brilliant. Brilliant.
Okay. Did you like Jason Donovan when you met him eventually?
He was a really nice guy. Yeah. He had such interesting stories. I mean, he's obviously, you know, lived several lifetimes since he put out this gorgeous single. But he was, yeah, he was lovely. He was really sweet. And like I say, he didn't seem to mind too much when I was telling him how crazy I was about him at the age of 10.
Okay. Your favourite album?
Now, this is quite the gear change, okay? So Joanna Newsom's Have One On Me is number one gorgeous because I think it's about 20 songs on this album. So it is really substantial. Now, the thing about Joanna Newsom is I've heard people say she sounds like Lisa Simpson, which I don't think so. I think
Lisa Simpson playing a harp.
Lisa Simpson playing a harp or playing the piano. But I think this is really affecting. And I used to play the harp as a teenager, right?
So,
yeah. So I understand that this is, and I think Joanna Newsom played the harp since she was 4 years old. So I listened to this, obviously, wondering about the finger work and about the playing. And it is actually quite, some of this album is really complicated harp playing, but it's beautiful. It's ambitious. It's a really ambitious album, and baroque and just affecting. Gorgeous.
This, I think, will be the second time on The Last Word we'll have heard Joanna Newsom. The first time was about 20 years ago when Stuart Clark from Hot Press used to do the music spot with us, and he selected it as his album of the week. And I remember telling him at the time, this is dreadful. And I listened to it and I said, Stuart, how can you be recommending? So I want to hear it again, Joanna. Now, this may be a different Joanna Newsom album, but so let's hear from the album Have One On Me, the track Good Intentions, Paving Company.
20 miles left to the shore. Hello, my old country. Hello. Stars are just beginning to appear, and I have never in my life before been here.
She's singing that.
She's a fully grown woman, if that's what you're getting at. Yeah. I mean, I think she was in her 30s, you know, when this album was put
out. Is it growing you if you listen to it lots of times?
Matt. Matt. I'd hoped in the 20 years since Stuart presented it to you that you might have like learned a thing or two about good music. I think it's gorgeous.
I'm not judging you. I'm just asking you to explain it. That's all.
You know what? I think there's something about Joanna Newsom that it's wholly original. I mean, you know, and there's some very, very, I mean, funnily enough, there's not a lick of harp in that particular song, obviously,
true,
you know. But if you listen to the rest of the album, it sort of just crescendos into this really dramatic arc. It's really, really beautiful. Go home and listen to all 20 songs and come back to me. That's your homework.
20, right. Okay.
20 odd, yeah.
All right. Okay, that's your favourite album. Favourite band or artist? Who are you going for?
Oh, well, My Bloody Valentine would be any day of the week, my total jam. I heard My Bloody Valentine when I was about maybe 14 in school. I had a friend who had bigger sisters who were much cooler than any of us. And I heard this and it actually scared me the first time I heard My Bloody Valentine.
Why?
Because it was abrasive. I mean, there's a lot of heavy guitars in there. It was not Jason Donovan, we'll put it that way. And I just remember kind of feeling very sort of pulled into it. It's woozy and it's sort of almost druggy and, you know, cloudy. And I remember going, God, this is wild that music can do this and have this sort of power, you know. And I saw them now in November. They played,
just gone by.
Yeah, they played, would you believe, the Three Arena, which was a bit of an interesting one. But they seem to just pull you into this underworld. I mean, I absolutely love it. They are so loud. I mean, I'm pretty sure if I have tinnitus, it is entirely down to this band. But I did hear this, you know, when I was 14, it changed everything. It coloured everything for me, you know, made me want to work in the music industry and work in music journalism. Lord only knows where I would be had I not heard this album.
Let's hear a little bit of My Bloody Valentine.
We'll be right back.
My Bloody Valentine and When You Sleep. Real 90s sound, isn't it?
I love it so much. I should have just been left in the 90s, really. I just love that era of music so much.
Because the best gig you were ever at was from that era as well.
When I was asked what my best gig, I mean, I have been to like thousands of shows, right? I mean, this is a question that nearly sent me into the hospital. But I have to say, I saw Radiohead in the Rock Garden about 2 weeks maybe before they released their first album.
So Pablo, where was the Rock Garden?
The Rock Garden was in Temple Bar, where Eamon Doran's is.
Oh yeah,
tiny little venue, really really small. And they had a band called Strange Love in support, who I really liked. Didn't even know that much about Radiohead, to be honest. But that day, I was in fifth year in school and I'd been given detention.
For being
naughty. Oh, I was a little horror. And I'm very sorry. If you happen to have been a teacher in my school, I apologise wholeheartedly for everything. Mount Sackville in Chapel Lizard. I'm just so sorry. And I hope the therapy bills weren't too extortionate. But so I was getting detention and my mother was like, you're going nowhere, not a hope. But somehow I managed to slip the lead and get out to the Rock Garden at the age of 15 and saw Radiohead in this tiny venue. And I just walked out afterwards and just fell out onto the cobblestones of Crown Alley and went, that was insane. And yeah, it was probably one of the first, you know, important shows that I saw. So that is absolutely etched on my DNA.
We don't have anything from that particular gig, but we do have from 1993, the same year, Radiohead performing in Chicago. And this is nice. Still a great song from that era, although I think they hate it now.
It's funny, I saw them at Primavera a couple of years ago and they played it, and it was a really big deal because they never play it anymore.
This is Creep.
Just like an angel, your skin makes me cry. You float like a feather in a beautiful world. I wish I was special. You're so fucking special. But I'm a creep. I'm a winner. What the hell am I doing here?
Somebody be given out to me for not doing the language warning in advance of that. But Radiohead, one of the great bands of the 90s who have endured.
Absolutely.
You still love them as much, do you?
I do love them. I love them so much. Yeah, they're fantastic.
Tanya Sweeney, stay with us because I want to get to the rest of your Culture Club choices when we come back after the traffic. Welcome back to the Culture Club. It's Tanya Sweeney with us this week. Her debut novel, Esther, is now following you. So let's move to away from the music. And we asked for a favourite movie, actor, or director. And you've gone for the director, Richard Linklater, and the Sunrise Trilogy. Tell us about this.
Oh, the Sunrise Trilogy is incredible. I think the first one of those came out in 1995. You're starting to see a pattern here, aren't you, Matt?
Yeah. You were very influenced by your teenage years.
I really was. I think everyone is. But, you know, Before Sunrise is about an American guy, played by Ethan Hawke, Jesse, who is travelling in Europe and meets a French woman by chance on a train. And they decide to get off in Prague before he flies back to the States and she goes on to Paris. And it's just them walking the streets of Prague, talking to each other and falling sort of slowly and quietly in love. Now, you also have to understand, right, it being 1995, picture the scene dating in Ireland. You'd go to a nightclub, you'd dance next to a lad. This is what happened for me anyway. You'd dance next to a lad, you'd maybe get off of them, you'd go back to the bed sit in Ranelagh, right? You did that 5 weeks in a row and then you maybe kind of called each other boyfriend and girlfriend. that was how it kind of was with us, right? So to see two people connecting, talking, respecting each other and actually falling in romantic love with each other by finding out about their likes and their quirks and their fears and their personality was really radical to me. It really was. And like Richard Linklater, I think actually had this happen to him. It was really crazy. He had a night in maybe Dallas or somewhere with a woman, and they lost contact, and he tried to find her, and that's why he wrote this film. And it turned out that she'd had actually died, you know. So it was, yeah, there's something, you know, really romantic in a way and poignant about the reason that this film exists in the first place.
The name of it again?
Before Sunrise.
Okay, let's hear a clip from it involving Jesse, played by Ethan Hawke, meeting the French woman Celine, played by Julie Delpy, on a train.
All right, I have an admittedly insane idea, but if I don't ask you this, it's just, you know, it's going to haunt me the rest of my life.
What?
I want to keep talking to you, you know? I have no idea what your situation is, but I feel like we have some kind of, connection, right?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, right. Well, great. So listen, here's the deal. This is what we should do. You should get off the train with me here in Vienna and come check out the town.
What?
Come on, it'll be fun.
Come on. What would we do?
I don't know. All I know is I have to catch an Austrian Airlines flight tomorrow morning at 9:30, and I don't really have enough money for a hotel, so I was just going to walk around, and it'd be a lot more fun if you came with me. And if I turn out to be some kind of psycho, you know, you just get on the next train. All right. Think of it like this. Jump ahead. 10, 20 years. Okay? And you're married. And only your marriage doesn't have that same energy that it used to have. You know, you start to blame your husband. You start to think about all those guys you've met in your life and what might have happened if you picked up with one of them, right? Well, I'm one of those guys. That's me. You know, so think of this as time travel from then to now to find out what you're missing out on. See, what this really could be is a gigantic favor to both you and your future husband to find out that you're not missing out on anything. I'm just as big a loser as he is, totally unmotivated, totally boring, and you made the right choice and you're really happy.
Let me get my bag.
It was reissued a year ago and got rave reviews for its 30th anniversary, partly on the basis that this is the way relationships develop between people without smartphones. That they would have been on, a modern day couple would have been on their smartphones all evening trying to contact somebody else.
Yeah, Facebook me. Yes, exactly. Yeah, no, it's actually, that's a really good point that it is just two people talking, you know. It's a very simple premise, but it's almost bizarre in this day and age, I'd say.
Okay, favourite play or musical, theatre show, what would you go for?
Oh my gosh, now this was another toughie, but I remember about 15 years ago, I was in the Young Vic in London. Now, I do love Martin McDonagh anyway, but I saw Rosaline Linehan and Susan Lynch star in The Beauty Queen of Lean Ann, which was absolutely phenomenal. I went with my friend Eklund, and Rosaline Linehan in the role of the mum. I mean, The Beauty Queen of Lean Ann is about a mother and a daughter who are living in very rural kind of Galway in a weird codependency / mutually hateful arrangement. And from there, things get pretty explosive and violent. And Rosaline Linehan was just absolutely fantastic in this play, you know, playing the mum. And Susan Lynch just encapsulated that frustration of being in your late 30s and stranded at home, you know, wanting to get out into the world and just stuck where you are, you know. It was absolutely phenomenal.
What other things would you mention?
I saw Denise Gough do Portia Coughlin. I love Marina Carr. I mean, I think she is one of our finest playwrights and I love what she does. And Portia Coughlin was, you know, it's a very challenging material, you know, but... And Denise Gough, I think, is one of our absolute finest. She did this amazing kind of intensity and, you know, not hysterical in a funny way, but hysterical in a kind of a crazy way. And I just remember coming out of that production absolutely shook.
Okay. Now, let's talk about books. I presume you read an awful lot as an author, or do you?
I love to read, yeah. I'd probably read a book a week, you know.
Okay.
Sometimes there's lulls, but, you know, I normally get back into it. Yeah.
And your favourite?
Now, I'm going to give proper respect and due respect to Marion Keyes, you know. And I've written about Marion a lot and I've interviewed her a lot. Number one, she's just an incredibly generous and incredibly wise person. And this generosity and wisdom ends up on the page immediately. There's something kind of fantastic about how she writes about, you know, things like eating disorders, domestic violence, addiction, the real dark, you know, crevices of the human condition. And on a line by line level, you are going, this is just so much fun and so funny. And I always think Marion does this thing where she makes it look easy. You know, it's very easy to be jealous of Marion because you think, well, I could do that too. But the thing is, it's very, very hard to do what she does, which is make, you know, a book look easy to write. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. She's brilliant at it.
Let's hear her read from her book, Grown Ups.
Bridie issued stern instructions to the younger kids that if their sorbets tasted in any way funny, they must desist from eating them with immediate effect. She actually said those words, desist, and with immediate effect. It was at times such as these that Johnny Casey wondered at the wisdom of sending children to expensive schools. They created monsters. Jessie resumed her spot at the head of the table. Everyone okay? She asked. Cheerful noises of assent rose, because that was how things rolled in Jessie's world. But when the hubbub quietened down, Ed's wife Cara said, I have to say it, I'm bored out of my skull. Good-humoured chortles followed, and someone murmured, You're gas. I'm not joking. Several heads jerked up from their sorbets. All conversations ceased. I mean, sorbets, Cara asked. How many more courses do we have to sit through? Couldn't we just have had a pizza? Okay, Cara had one or two issues, to put it mildly. But she was a sweetheart, one of the nicest people he'd ever met. Johnny's gaze went to Ed. It was his job to keep his wife under control. If that wasn't a very sexist thought, and yes, he admitted it was.
That was a bit of Marion Keyes reading from the book Grown Ups. Tell us about your other favourite though, Curtis Sittenfeld.
Oh, I love Curtis. I read Prep, which was a book set in a East Coast American prep school. And Curtis Sittenfeld has always cleaved to a certain type of character, which is, you know, cynical, bookish, socially awkward, but very astute. This is a typical Sittenfeld heroine. And it started with Lee in Prep in the mid-noughties. And she's just really kept on that, you know. So I love it. And again, there's just an ease. It's very easy to read, but it's very astute and very sharp.
Okay, television. It does not surprise me, given your 90s bias, that the programme you remember most from your childhood is Beverly Hills 90210, the original.
Oh, stop. Listen, in my defence, I was living in deepest, darkest Blanchardstown, right? So, you know, you see all the sort of, you know, Rodeo Drive business and the palm trees and you are transported to a whole other world. And I remember it was on Saturday afternoons in Ireland and, yeah, there were teenagers getting nose jobs, lads. I mean, it was just mind-bending, you know, back in the kind of late 80s and early 90s. Phenomenal. And then Beverly Hills 90210 sort of morphed into this weird music thing where they had the Peach Pit, which was this their hangout. But there'd always be all these fantastic bands showing up at the Peach Pit. I mean, privilege beyond measure, like. But I just always was so blown away by how exotic it was and the way they wore this privilege and this money well. I'd always hope to do it myself one day. I'm still waiting.
Your pick, though, for something modern is one that I actually haven't given a go at yet. And I just wasn't caught by the trailers for it, which you're into The Four Seasons written by Tina Fey.
Yeah, I will buy whatever Tina Fey is selling on site. I think she is just amazing. And there's something about, I mean, The Four Seasons is set in kind of, it examines that sort of late 40s, early 50s situation where people have been married for about 30 years. And it starts off with one of the most seemingly solid marriages in their group of friends imploding, you know. And there's something very, very authentic about the way Tina Fey writes about these relationships, you know. I mean, she's not afraid to go there to the warts and all and to really show you how miserable it can be to be there.
Well, let's hear a clip from The Four Seasons, Steve Carell and Colman Domingo.
Do you think you're the first old man to date a younger woman? You're joining a long tradition of May-December relationships, But you are doing it all wrong.
What are you talking about?
As of December, we're supposed to pull the maze up to our way of life. We do not get dragged down to theirs.
But I like feeling young again.
When you go to the ancient Greek pottery section of the Met, are there images of old men down on the ground with younger women playing marbles? No. They're drinking wine and listening to a goddamn harp.
Okay.
You should be introducing Jenny to the pleasures of high threat count sheets, not sleeping on a mattress that smells like a cold sidewalk.
I understand you feel strongly about this.
I'm gonna kill you.
No, could you just pretend, please? Please.
Fine.
Everything Steve Carell in is usually good anyway.
Absolutely. He's brilliant.
Okay. And we don't have time to talk about your love of the Traitors, because I want to get to your buried treasure, something you believe people should know a bit more about. And it's a book.
Yeah. I'm astounded more people don't know about this book, to be honest. It's a book called The Girls by Laurie Lansons that came out in the mid-noughties. And very briefly, it is about a set of a pair of conjoined twins living in rural Ontario in kind of an unspecified time in the 20th century. And one of them receives a terminal illness diagnosis, which means they are both going to die. So the book alternates between their vantage points, you know. It's a diary entries from Ruby and Rosa, the two women. And one of them is very gregarious and spiky and funny, and the other is much more bookish and reserved. So it kind of flips between both of their vantage points as they move towards this, you know, through this diagnosis and on this journey.
Okay, that's The Girls by Laurie Lansons. That's it, unfortunately, time-wise. Tanya Sweeney, it has been terrific having you here on the Culture Club. Congratulations on the first novel, first of many, I believe. Esther is now following you, is the name of the book.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.